The United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. The Honorable Margaret Bartley presiding. All who have business before this court draw near and you shall be heard. God bless the United States and this honorable court. Please be seated.
Good afternoon. I'm Judge Bartley, and I'm joined today by Judge Toth and Judge Lahr. And this is our first hybrid oral argument. Judges are present in the courtroom, and counsel are appearing remotely. We're here today for the matter of Thomas Stevenson, Jr. versus Dennis McDonough, Secretary of Veterans Affairs, docket number 20-4870. And we will be considering the veteran's 38 U.S.C. 1151 claim. Counsel for the parties, please state your name and your appearance for the record, beginning with appellant's counsel.
This is Attorney Maxwell Kinman representing the appellant Thomas Stevenson, Jr. Thank you.
Thank you. With my colleague Sarah Wolf representing the Department of Veterans. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kinman and Ms. Kupke. Each party will have 30 minutes to present argument. Mr. Kinman, how much time would you like to reserve?
Chief Judge Bartley, I would like to reserve 10 minutes for rebuttal, please.
Okay, thank you. And Mr. Kinman, you may proceed when you're ready.
Thank you, Chief Judge Bartley, and may it please the court. Your Honors, this matter involves 38 U.S.C. 1151, and specifically under that statute, what is provided as a qualifying additional disability. We can look at regulation of that statute, so 38 CFR 3.361. Under that regulation, to determine whether or not a veteran has a qualifying additional disability, the VA is required to look at the veteran's condition before surgical treatment, and then look at the veteran's condition after the conclusion of such treatment. In this matter, the board determined that the veteran, Mr. Stevenson, does not have an additional qualifying disability. Throughout the decision, the board was clear. Record page 7, the board stated that the examiner concluded there was no evidence of an unhealed wound, there was no evidence of additional disability, and throughout its decision, the board relied on this 2019 medical opinion, which determined that Mr. Stevenson did not have an additional disability. It is clear, at the time of that exam, the appellant did not have a disability at that time. What he has claimed throughout this process is that after his surgery at the VA, after the radiofrequency ablation that he was provided, an open wound was there for several months. He filed this claim while that open wound was still there. He was being treated by several months by nurses. He was being treated at home. And he asserts that this wound, which was caused from the radiofrequency ablation, is such an additional disability. In the medical opinion, it appeared that the...
Mr. Kinman, I want to ask you a question. So what's the relevant time period for the additional disability? Is it the date the claim was filed?
Yes, so it doesn't matter. The claim was filed basically the month after the surgery was provided. So his wound, the radiofrequency ablation, was in July of 2014, and then he filed his initial claim the very next month. Now, the wound did heal, and so what the appellant is seeking here is just a matter of months of disability compensation under the statute. Clearly, the wound is no longer there. Now, he may have some secondary issues or perhaps a stage rating of a 0% due to that wound and to that scar, but the wound is clear. It was only there for a matter of about 4 months.
And so, counsel, it seems to be your position. So let's step back a minute. So 1151 does not clarify the the time period that you're breaking this up into different segments, and the secretary is kind of treating them all as one single segment or period of time. So is it 1151 doesn't say anything about the time period or how to break up these events, the event that might cause injury? It doesn't say anything. Is that correct?
Yes, Chief Judge Bartley. 1151 does not say anything. However, the regulation providing under 1151, 38 CFR Section 3.361, that provides that the timeline is after the completion or conclusion of the surgical treatment. So if Mr. Stevenson had been hospitalized the entirety of his care, perhaps there was a wound and or a surgery that required him to be placed in a medically induced coma or something of that nature, I don't think we'd have a claim here. What we have in this matter is that he was seen for a surgery. It is a relatively minor surgery, the radiofrequency ablation. He was released from that surgery, released to go home. And then over the next several months, he developed MRSA, a staph infection. And because of that, the wound was unable to be healed. He had to have in-home nursing care. And he had to live in, of course, pain with an open wound on the side of his stomach for many months after that surgery. So I think I would look to CFR 3.61.
So, Cass, I want to ask, you know, I mean, eventually you'd have to show the proximate cause, and there's a couple of different ways to do that. One would be to show breach of the duty of care. Another would be to show something like an unforeseen event. Which of those two are you proceeding on? Is it that the staph infection was something that was reasonably foreseen, or is it that there was some breach of the treatment? It was subpar in some aspect.
I believe the veteran, Mr. Stevenson, could proceed under either of those theories of the case. And the problem we have here is that we didn't get to that. This case was denied by the board, as Mr. Stevenson is arguing, because the board determined he did not have an additional disability. So certainly if this matter is remanded, Mr. Stevenson can present evidence that there was some sort of malpractice or proximate cause from the initial radio frequency ablation that resulted in a MRSA infection, or he could submit evidence that this was not a reasonably foreseeable outcome of a radio frequency ablation procedure. Unfortunately, the board didn't address that, and the board based its decision on the fact that there was no disability here. And Mr. Stevenson and our argument is that certainly there is no current disability. However, at those time after the surgery, after the completion of the radiofrequency ablation, there was then disability for this matter of months, and that is how this case should proceed.
Now, Mr. Kinman, let me just follow up on my earlier question. So you're arguing that the under 3.361B, the treatment that we're talking about here for 1151 purposes didn't stop until VA completed its treatment of the MRSA infection and the open wound. That's what the secretary is arguing. You're arguing that, no, the treatment stopped when VA provided the ablative procedure, and that we should look at immediately after the ablation or within a week or two when the wound opened up and it started draining and things like that, and he started having pain. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And but in terms of the regulation and how it defines additional disability, is it clear from the regulation which of you are correct? Does the regulation go into sufficient detail as far as how to define the event or the treatment?
The regulation does not. And the regulation, unfortunately, doesn't have a indication as to what the fact finder should use to determine when there's a bright line when treatment ends or not. And because of that, we would argue that based on the pro-veteran nature of the system, and you can look at several cases, Vigas versus Shinseki is one summary of that, the 1151 claims are very pro-veteran, that the line, if this court is going to provide such a line, should be pro-veteran. And if you were to follow the Secretary's argument that there is treatment and that treatment still continued, then I don't think you could really ever have 1151 claims, because in any sort of medical malpractice, or in most medical malpractice situations, you have an individual that suffers further medical consequences. And so the Secretary's argument seems to be, well, if there's an injury or if there's something wrong that happens during a medical procedure, then that's not an additional disability until that medical procedure or issue is fixed. And so under that rule, 1151 claims would be nearly impossible, because anytime there's going to be malpractice, or at least most of the time there's going to be malpractice, the individual who is injured is going to continue to seek medical care to get that situation rectified. And I look at the regulation.
Mr. Kinman, doesn't your position have a similar difficulty, because VA would have a duty to mitigate any complications that arose, such as complications from a ablative procedure? And that's what they did. They were trying to correct it. I'm sorry, from the gallbladder surgery. So they were trying to correct the scar problem by doing the ablation. And then he developed a problem with the ablation and got the MRSA. And then they tried to fix that. So there, it seems as though maybe you're having the same problem that you envision for VA. This is continuing. And you want to keep stopping it at these perhaps very small incremental points. You want to stop treatment and say, oh, this is wrong. I had 2 days of headache because they did this particular procedure. Then the next week I had 2 days of bleeding because they were trying to help, you know, cure the headache. And then it just seeming to spiral on, these events, with seemingly endless opportunities for veterans to have 1151 claims.
Yes, Chief Judge Bartley. My response to that is, we are not, Mr. Stevenson had no claim that the initial gallbladder surgery was performed incorrectly. The claim is that the radiofrequency ablation was either performed incorrectly or there was an unforeseen consequence of the radiofrequency ablation. And to kind of supplement your argument and your response, I would argue that after the gallbladder surgery, there was no additional disability. He had have a scar that developed, and if a scar was not a reasonably foreseeable outcome, then yes, he could have filed an 1151 claim. Here with the radiofrequency ablation, we have a MRSA infection developing. And his argument is that MRSA infection caused an additional disability. So, you know, I don't foresee veterans after a surgery filing an 1151 claim because they have a headache for a day or they feel drowsy from anesthesia. But if there are injuries and additional disabilities after a surgery, they should be able to file those 1151 claims, irregardless of how many claims they may have. I understand that the VA is going to continue to treat individuals who have problems following a surgery, but just because the treatment is continuing doesn't mean that their ability to file a claim under 1151 should be foreclosed, or that these veterans need to go to an outside treatment provider. They should be able to continue to treat, just like if this was a regular civil action. If there's a malpractice claim outside of the VA, certainly that individual can still treat those issues, whatever it may be, and get healed and fixed, and that shouldn't preclude them from saying that the original surgery or procedure was some type of malpractice.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Kinman. And does, in your view, does 3.361 or the statute, but I don't think the statute really does this, does 3.361 actually define the disability part of additional disability?
I don't see a definition of the disability in the regulation. I think what it does is say the before and after part. So section B there says that to determine whether there's an additional disability, you look at the veteran before the surgical procedure, and then you look at the veteran after the surgical procedure. And you look at those two, the before and after, and if there is something new that has occurred, some new disability, that is what is in the regulation. So I don't think that regulation provides a strong or significant definition as to what that means. And again, that would, I believe, error on the side of the appellant and the veterans in this matter, that they, you know, that there has not been a regulation clearly defining when the start and the stop times are. So under our pro-veteran system and under the 1151 claims and case law, that should be weighed in favor of the veteran, where here there's clearly some sort of issue after the surgery, after the radiofrequency ablation. There is an open wound, and he filed his claim timely. So he filed his claim while the open wound was there. If he would not have filed his claim in that timely manner, then there would not have been a disability.
And so what you basically said was, I think you were agreeing with me that the regulation uses the term additional disability, but then it seems to only address, in explaining what additional disability is, it seems to only address what additional means or how you measure additional, and does not define disability, doesn't try to explain what a disability is.
Yes, Your Honor, that is correct.
Thank you.
Mr. Kinman, this is Judge Lauer. Question for you. So far, we have been discussing the MRSA infection, but upon review of the record, it appears that the January 2019 examiner found that appellant's scar had actually worsened from approximately 2 centimeters to 19 centimeters, and that's in the record at 7203 and 7206. In your opinion, did the board err when it failed to consider whether a larger scar was also perhaps an additional disability?
Well, I certainly think you can make that argument. The way I foresaw this, if the veteran was going to be found to have an additional disability and it was due to some unforeseen error, I think the proper way to rate it would be based off of the initial problem, meaning the open wound, and there's several diagnostic codes where that could fit under for those matter of months. But then after that, you can certainly rate the scar as the additional disability following that. Now, the board, again, it is a relatively brief board decision, and they do not address the scar issue. To be frank, the veteran himself, that's not his main issue. His main issue is that there was an open wound that had to be treated. But if this was to be remanded and eventually granted, I think there is a very strong argument that you would first rate it based on the open wound and then next rate it based on the scar and the increase in the scar. But the board did not address that in its decision.
I have no further questions.
Oh, Mr. Kinman, yeah, do you have?
All right.
Okay, Mr. Kinman, did you want to wrap up?
Yes.
And we'll revisit on...
With no further questions, I can revisit on my remaining rebuttal time. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Kinman. Ms. Kupke?
Madam Chief Judge Bartley, and may it please the Court, Judge Toth and Judge Lauer, I am here to respectfully ask the Court to affirm the Board March 25, 2020 decision that found the veteran is not entitled to 1151 benefits because no additional disability was found. Respectfully, I'd like to address the questions that were posed to counsel, and I would like to start with Chief Judge Bartley. You mentioned that the statute does not currently define the time period and the additional part in the, or the disability part in the word disability. And Your Honor, my response to that would be that it's a very fact-specific situation in 1151 claims. So the statute needs to provide for flexibility to allow the adjudicators and the medical experts and the board to have some room in order of which to navigate. And in this instance, the original procedure on July 1st, 2014, based on the medical records, went without complication. And the veteran in the nursing notes indicated that he declined wound care. So I would argue that that fact means that wound care is part of the treatment of the procedure. And so when we're looking at the regulation definition of treatment beginning and treatment end, it is our position that the treatment began with the procedure and did not end until the wound care was completed, which appears to be sometime in October of 2014, but at the latest in February of 2015. So in our opinion...
Ms. Kupke, even though counsel just said that the veteran had no problem with the gallbladder surgery, and it wasn't until, I think it was a few weeks after the July surgery that he started having the pain and swelling that ended up requiring the ablation. You're saying that this was all a single event of treatment. That's the Secretary's position?
No, Your Honor, I respectfully disagree with the characterization of the facts here. The original gallbladder removal surgery was in 2012. The veteran suffered a scar from that surgery and had pain in that scar, which he tried to treat with several different ways. And he was finally diagnosed with a scar neuroma, a painful scar. And the ablation procedure, which in our opinion started the treatment, sought to address the pain in the scar. It's basically radio frequency waves are being used to kill or numb the nerves in the scar so it can no longer transmit pain to the brain. So he went in with a painful scar from the gallbladder surgery. That procedure we're talking about sought to fix that problem. And the consent form, the medical records here indicate that that procedure itself will cause a breaking of the skin, and that can lead to infection, pain, and bleeding. It's a foreseeable event of, unfortunately, of this type of procedure. So
just to be clear, the treatment event that we're talking about that's covered by 3.361 here is in your view, began with the ablation and then ended after the wound closed.
Correct, Your Honor. So we're talking about the time period from July 1st, 2014 to arguably October of 2014. And I believe counsel has acknowledged the same in his briefs to the court.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. So that, in my opinion, addresses the fact of the time period that is being defined in 3.361B. And then we're talking about the disability part. And it is, again, it has to provide everybody involved in the process with some flexibility because it is fact dependent. So here, the wound that became infected was part of the treatment. And because the wound resolved, the disability was not additional in the sense of the statute as a legal term. And because 1151 claims require that the veteran must meet each element before we move on to the next, which is proximate cause and actual causation, it's fatal. If he can't show an additional disability, we will not get to actual causation or proximate cause. And that
counsel, I want to pause here because this is, you kind of came to my question, which is there's obviously three elements. So the first is an additional disability. The second is actual causation. The third is proximate causation. And the third element can kind of go in different directions, whether it's sort of a consent-based claim, a duty of care, or this unforeseeable circumstances. My difficulty is I'm having a tough time mapping the facts found by the board decision onto the basic sort of analysis of elements. Can you tell me, how do you interpret the board decision? Like what facts are relevant to which element in the board decision?
Of course, Your Honor. First, we wish always for more thoroughness and more clarity in each board decision. It could have been laid out a little bit better, but I would argue that the board relied on the February 2019 VA medical expert opinion, and that expert certainly looked at the underlying medical record. He referred to the treatment period. He referred to the procedure that was started the whole process. He referred to the wound care, wound diagnosis, and whether or not all that was appropriate. So in terms of mapping out the claim, I would say that's the veteran's burden, but the facts that support the board decision can be found here via the medical expert opinion. I'm sorry, Your Honor, I can't hear you.
Sorry. Let's take the first element, right? I know the Holcomb case, we defined it as a qualifying additional disability, but I don't know if that's quite correct because 1151 itself, the whole inquiry is to find out whether it's a qualifying additional disability. I think that the first element might have two different ways to look at it. One would be you obviously need to have a disability, and the second would be, in a sense, it has to be additional, right? And I think that, you know, it's possible that some of the before-after discussion we're having is really just about whether it's actually additional or if it's just part of the same disability that that person is receiving treatment for. Can you speak to that? I mean, is it the fact that, are you saying the board found that there's no disability, meaning he was completely healed, and so the actual, like, the disability part would be the missing fact of that element, or was it it was not additional in that it was just part of the treatment for the disability for which, you know, he was already under VA care. I'm just having a hard time understanding what the board actually found as to the actual elements.
Yes, Your Honor, the board focused on the first element, the additional disability, and there is the term of art that we look at it as in a legal context, and then there is the actual, the plain meaning of the word disability. And the board found that based on the definition of actual additional disability under the statute, that that element had not been shown. So it is not so much a finding that the veteran did not suffer a consequence from the original treatment temporarily via that infected wound, but from a legal perspective and to establish entitlement to 1151 compensation, he did not meet his burden based on the facts.
So the disability, whatever disability he's alleged, was just a consequence of the treatment itself. It was the underlying disability for which he received treatment, and it was, in a sense, the expected healing process of that disability. Is that am I twisting that, or is that the finding that it was not additional to the existing disability?
Your Honor, I wanted to make sure that the gallbladder surgery is not in the context of VA treatment. I'm not sure if the veteran received that as VA care, but I think we do not argue that that started the problem and that later led to the procedure to fix the pain. And in addition to that, the disability, the wound infection was a foreseeable event, unfortunate event, but I think we all know that wound infection can happen after you have surgery and you have a wound that is separate from the...
Yeah, so I know this is a bit painful, but I really am trying to understand this. That's the third element, right, which would be whether this would be an unforeseen aspect of the treatment, right? And that would be, but now we're dealing with proximate causation. We're not dealing with whether there's an, whether there's a, maybe a disability separate from the one for which the person's receiving treatment. And the reason I'm struggling with this is I'm struggling to see the relevance of this before after argument that you're making. Now, I understand in practical terms, when you're going to compare something, you need to compare it to something, right? So you'd compare it to what the person looked like before that they undergo treatment. I'm just not quite sure what, why we have to necessarily pin a after moment and the implications of that. And again, the reason I'm trying to sort this out is it's relevant to whether we're deciding something under the first element or the third. I feel like it can play differently. This before after thing plays very differently depending on which part of the sort of where we are in the kind of element sequence. And I'm just having a hard time sort of mapping this on to what our analysis should be. Are we looking for an additional disability? Is it something separate from the treatment? Or is it, should the way that we identify that something unforeseen, in this case, we're really down, like we'll concede the first element, we'll put all our focus in on how, on maybe the reasonability of being able to foresee this. So I know that's a lot, that's a big question, but what I'm asking is what's the before after distinction vis-a-vis these elements, actual additional disability versus proximate causation? Where should we be focusing our analysis?
I would respond to that. We need a starting point because the whole intent behind 1151 is to compensate veterans when there was some wrongdoing, some medical malpractice. I guess somebody did something and they did it outside of the standard of care or what is foreseeable, and the veteran suffered a consequence from that. But medical treatment is not an exact science. Things can go wrong, even if everything is done right. And so you cannot skip around the additional disability part first and get to proximate cause first, even though most of 1151 claims, based on my legal research, are decided on the proximate cause element. Here we have a case where we're dealing with the additional disability, and I think it's unique because the wound is the claimed additional disability and the wound healed. If he had suffered a different consequence, then it would be much clearer to all of us, yes or no, there is an additional disability. But what I would like to urge the court against is combining the elements of a traditional 1110 service connection claim and an 1151 claim. They are different for a reason. We need something in addition. Once all three elements are met under 1151, do we then treat the veteran's claim as if he, as we would proceed with any other service connection claim, and only then would, as counsel urges, come in, was there a disability at doing some point of the claim and staged ratings, is that appropriate? Those are all, staged ratings are a downstream issue, but the disability part, the current disability part analysis is a little bit different in 1151 cases.
Well, I'm not sure. Are you done responding to Judge Toth then? Because I was going to move in a different direction a little bit.
I have Judge Toth.
Oh, okay. Thank you. Yes, go ahead and ask you.
Okay. So some of this seemed a little bit random to me. And the part that seemed a little random in this development and adjudication of this claim is that it seems as though the result here depended almost entirely on the moment at which the veteran was examined. So he was examined, I think, in January. So the ablation occurred in July, and then he started having the neuroma he started having the bleeding, the wound, open wound, well, in you know, August or September. In August, I think, because he got visiting nurse treatment or something then. And then he wasn't examined until January. Is that true? Or was there an examination in the fall when his wound was still open?
Your Honor, are you talking about the VA medical opinion or examination as part of normal medical examination to treat his wound?
Well, I remember looking at the record, and I thought there were two VA. Well, there were several VAEs. There was a gallbladder one in the record. I thought there was a scar one. But the ones that were relevant to this 1151 claim that the board saw as relevant to the 1151, they were all performed after the wound had closed. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct. And I understand. I understand.
And so it seems like if they'd scheduled an exam, you know, while the wound was open, this might have had a different outcome, because at that point he would have had a wound that was leaking, or whatever you call it, exuding, and it was painful. And they just happened to do the examination that the comp and pen VAE here after it was finished. But, you know, that was kind of random. Like, oh, it was scheduled then, and that's when they did it. But if they had done it 2 months earlier, could there have been a different outcome?
No, Your Honor, I would argue not. The medical records that we have span from July 2014 to February 2015, during which time the veteran was treated for the wound. And that the VA medical opinion you're talking about, the SCAR DBQ and the 1151 opinion, those were obtained in February of 2019. Those were obtained in response to the veteran's argument, something went wrong here. I have an 1151 claim. So the board then went to obtain a medical opinion to find out, well, what happened to this veteran? Is it medical negligence? Did something go wrong? Did they not meet the standard of care? So at that point in 2019, the wound had healed, and the examiner did not just say the wound is healed today, so therefore there is no additional disability. He said, in addition to the wound having healed in 2014, 2015, he does not have a wound today in 2019. But he did provide the board with the necessary medical factual information to determine what the state was of the claimed disability by the veteran.
Oh, could you just repeat that last sentence? I didn't catch it.
Sure, Your Honor. I'm arguing that the 2019 VA examiner provided the board with the underlying medical information to determine if there was an additional disability in 2014, 2015. I was responding to counsel's assertion that the board denied this claim based on the fact that there was no disability in 2019. But that is not true. 2019 is when the examiner looked back at the medical treatment, looked at the evidence to decide, was there wrongdoing here on behalf of VA? That's usually how it is done. It's not concurrent to the treatment. It's afterwards, in the context of this claim, of these type of claims, that somebody has to look back and evaluate the medical evidence to decide, is there malpractice, medical malpractice?
But wouldn't you agree that the only reason they found that there was no additional disability was because by the time the examination occurred, the wound had closed and there was no open wound at that point? You're saying that is not what the examiner said? Can you just point to a record site if you disagree or show me?
Yes.
Where is
Yes, Your Honor, I absolutely. So the exam I'm working off, is it's several times in the record, is on pages 7208 through 7209, or the rope record is 77 through 78. I don't know which one is easier for you to find. But the examiner said, from 7/1/2014 to 9/26/2014, the veteran received a timely diagnosis and proper treatment of surgical scar neuroma. That's the painful scar for which he even had this procedure, and subsequent wound care. The wound has completely healed. So the examiner looked at the treatment he received to provide a medical opinion as to whether or not that was done appropriately.
So you were reading from between, where were you reading from? You gave me a range of pages and not a single page number.
Yes, Your Honor, let me get something out of here. I'm sorry to confuse the court further. In my specific notes on every single page of the RBA, I have it on page 7218. But on that record, you will find the language that I just quoted to you.
Okay, that's what I was looking at. You sounded like you were saying that the examiner did not find that there was no additional disability just by referencing the state of the wound at the time of the examination. But in fact, it seems like he did. Dr. Chang said, the wound closed completely in 2015. Today's evaluation further confirms that the surgical wound is closed. There is no evidence of additional disability as the surgical wound has completely healed. So that my point in referencing why, this seems random due to the timing. It all depends on when you examine the veteran. If Dr. Chang had examined the veteran back in a month after the ablative procedure, then the wound would have been opened. You agree with me on that? And it seems like in that case, I don't know whether the doctor could have said there's no additional disability because he would have had an open running painful wound.
Yes, Your Honor. If he had been If he had been examined sometime prior to the wound closing healing, he would have had a wound, and I would expect the examiner to say he has a wound.
He didn't have a open wound before the ablation.
Correct.
He had a painful scar, but not a wound, not an open wound.
Correct, Your Honor. He had a painful scar, and the procedure sought to treat the pain in the scar. Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I have a follow-up. I'm struggling to find out where the examiner compared the wound in question here that as a result of the RFA procedure before July 2014. I think we've established in the record that after the procedure, whether we're looking at, the February 2015 or certainly by the time the CMP examiner reviewed the history for the January 2019, but can you point me to where specifically the examiner compared the wound before the procedure?
I made a note about your question to opposing counsel for this as well. We do not have, I believe, in the record a measurement of the scar that the veteran went in with on July 1st. So we basically here have a scar upon a scar. And the original scar is not an issue. The scar at all, if at all, is the scar caused subsequent or due to the radio frequency ablation. And we do have medical records that describe the size and the depth of the scar. And the VA examiner did not compare the two scars or the scar that he didn't have before the procedure, but he did have after the procedure. He did not. But the argument here is has always been from the veteran, he shouldn't have had an infected wound, not that he shouldn't have had a scar.
I'd like to follow up with the same question that I had for Mr. Kinman regarding the difference in the scar as a result of the that was measured after the RFA procedure versus the 2019 CMP examiner's difference. We've gone from approximately a 2 centimeter long scar to a 19 centimeter scar. If you look at the difference there, how do you, I mean, obviously this court is not fact-finding here, but it goes back to the question I had for Mr. Kinman about potential additional disability as a result of that as well.
Respectfully, Your Honor, can you point me to the record where you find the measurements of the scar that you're referring to after the procedure?
I'd be happy to. Compare the record at 7203 with 7206, and there's actually some subsequent pages, all from the January 2019 CMP exam. So, but the first one is on 7206, where on the trunk of Mr. Stevenson's body, we have one scar at issue, 19 centimeters by 0.3 centimeters for a 5.7 centimeters square. And then also in the DBQ regarding the scars, it gives the same numbers. So how do we explain that?
Yes, that scar respectfully refers to the gallbladder removal surgery, a scar that stemmed from a different procedure, not from the procedure we're talking about in this case. That scar, that's not the same scar. So it hasn't, he didn't go in with a smaller scar and he has now a big scar because of the ablation treatment.
Now I'm even more confused because wasn't the RFA, the ablation procedure performed on the original scar for the surgery performed on the gallbladder?
Correct.
As I understood it, there was a scar as a result of the original surgery, the emergency surgery that was performed. The veteran then had pain at the scar, which the RFA treatment was intended to relieve. So how would it be at a different location than the original scar?
You want there's only one scar. I'm not arguing there's a different scar. There's only one scar, but that stemmed from the 2012 gallbladder removal surgery. And the ablation procedure, to the extent that I understand it, is a needle that gets inserted into the scar. And through that needle, hollow needle, radio frequency rays is being shot into the body with the hopes of hitting the nerve and killing the nerve, or at least quieting the nerve, which transmits the pain to the brain, which is what he was trying to do. And there's only one scar, and that scar is related to the gallbladder surgery, not to the radio frequency ablation procedure. That was a wound that healed and did not result in the big scar.
And so I, as well as Judge Lohr, noticed the difference in the size of the scars. There was a 19 centimeter, and then, but I think most of, there were two mentions of 19 centimeter by 0.3. And then there were several that said 3 centimeters. And that it was 3 centimeters long. And so I thought that maybe Judge Lauer was referring to that, the difference in those.
Well, actually, you know, again, reading from the record, I'm at 7203, and I'm quoting here. In a follow-up visit on September 26, 2014, the wound was noted to be 2 centimeters long. And then it goes on, in a subsequent visit to February 7, 2015, the wound was, it should say completely, but it says completed, healed, and closed. So this is part of the confusion. It appears that referring to the same scar here without differentiating a wound as a result of the RFA procedure and the original scar. So I'm still not convinced that we're talking about the same area, or in this case, you know, a difference between the scar created as a result of the RFA procedure versus the original scar post emergency procedure for the gallbladder.
Let's add 10 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Judge Lauer, when I'm looking at the medical records, and as you stated, in September of 2014, so roughly about 4 months out from the ablation procedure, the wound was 2 centimeters long. And this is the measurement of the wound caused by the procedure that VA attempted to treat and heal. And when the veteran went back for his final checkup in February of 2015, the VA opinions are dated in February of 2019, but in February of 2015, the final wound care appointment indicated there was no more, I don't want to misquote to you what the record says exactly. There's no reference to any scar relating to the wound. And yes, the records are a little bit confusing in that regard. And the best I can explain it is that it was a wound with a temporary scar on a scar that was already there, which he taught to treat. But it is confusing. I agree with you, Your Honor. And I would like to redirect the court also to the fact that the veteran is not arguing that he has a scar when he shouldn't have had a scar. He's arguing that he had a temporary wound that he should not have had. So respectfully, that needs to be the focus of the facts here, was that temporary wound and whether or not that is an additional disability in the context of 1151.
So that's a perfect segue to a McLean-type question. So as you know, in McLean and Romanowski, you know, if a veteran has a condition while the claim is pending, but it resolves prior to a final decision, then the veteran can still get service-connected for that disability. So what would require different treatment here? I understand perfectly that 1151 is not disability compensation, you know, related to service.
Yes, Your Honor, thank you. And that case sought to address a traditional service connection claim, not an 1151 claim. How should we handle this differently? We need to provide the legal world, I guess, if it comes to that, with a endpoint and a starting point in terms of the treatment, surgery. The statute provides for various ways VA can cause an 1151 claim. We need to provide some type of the additional disability is there for a reason to distinguish it from disability in the traditional sense, and because those are two different vehicles under which we seek to address a wrong and provide compensation to the veteran.
So hopefully this is the follow-up. So what's the significance of the temporary nature of the wound? Like, let's just say it's a wound, right? Not a temporary wound. What's different?
What is different, Your Honor? Some of the memdecs that I reviewed in preparation for this, there is something outside of that. There is... I did not review this, but what we know, traditionally speaking, you went in to cut off the left leg and you got the right leg amputated, things like that, that are much more easily definable in terms of an additional disability. A wound is very tough to put in this context, factually speaking, because hopefully a wound is always a temporary situation. But the that's why not only do we deal with the medical condition that's being claimed or the injury that's being claimed, but that's why we have the other two elements before we tie it all up and establish an 1151 claim. I am arguing that the statute and the rules and regulations are sufficient to address these types of cases.
I have another question. It's probably a big one, so I don't want to interrupt the chief's chain here.
Oh, well, yeah, let me go, because I do have another question on the temporary. So you're arguing that Section 1151 would preclude coverage of a disability that resolves quickly. I don't know. Or a disability that's temporary. You don't dispute, do you, that he had a disability when the wound was open and running? Or do you?
I do not dispute. He got more than he went up there. I would also not argue that it's never possible that a temporary condition would be fatal to establishing an 1151 claim. It depends on the facts. It depends on what happened and what the consequence is of the original, what started the whole problem. So, yes, Your Honor, and only in this case, based on these facts, the consent form that the veteran signed lists bleeding, infection, and pain at the needle insertion site as a consequence of this procedure. And once...
Aren't you confusing the issue there? I mean, the fact that something is listed on the consent form maybe would show that there was no fault on the part of VA, there's no carelessness because this is a normal thing that happens. It wouldn't go to whether there is an additional disability, would it? Could you just talk about that a little bit?
Sure, Your Honor. Maybe that was misleading in terms of the consent form. You're right. That is more intended towards addressing foreseeable versus unforeseeable events. But I would argue that the procedure, when it was first performed on July 1st, 2014, the nursing notes indicate it went without complication, the patient was released, and he declined wound care. That is in the records, and I would say that provides a strong support for finding that the wound care is part of that procedure. It wasn't like he went in for a massage and somehow suffered a wound. The wound was an anticipated part of the treatment.
Do you know what it means to decline wound care?
Your Honor, I would interpret it as meaning he did not want to have his wound cared for because he did not have a need for that. But I don't want to speculate. I'm only repeating what's in the record.
Okay, so just to summarize, and then I'll pass it off to Judge Toth. You're saying that a temporary condition is not fatal to an 1151 claim in terms of establishing that you have an additional disability, but under the circumstances here, because wound care was mentioned in on the consent form for the ablation, then it should be part of this treatment that he received, the whole wound episode. And so he doesn't have, and then it closed, and so he doesn't have an additional disability. That's your position.
Only as pertaining to the facts of the case. Your Honor, the records do not establish that there is an additional disability in the sense of the statute, but that does not mean a temporary disability could never constitute an additional disability under the statute. Yes, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah, so I kind of want to tie together the question I asked earlier with something that the Chief mentioned, which is I understand everything you're saying, but to me it all seems relevant to the sort of proximal cause, right? Which is, I mean, the way I generally see the three elements is the first two are relatively open-ended, and the third is where you can make discrete fact findings. I mean, whether something's reasonably foreseeable, I think people can explain what that means. You know, informed consent is a totally different thing. And then there would be discrete findings as to whether this would be a breach of care. I think everything you cited is relevant. I mean, certainly probative to whether those factors existed or not. I'm really struggling to kind of import all of this analysis into this first element, right? And I'm conceptually trying to make sense of this kind of before, after. I understand the before. It's sort of the control in the experiment. But what would be the time period of the after? And that's now I want to tie it together with Chief's question, which he mentioned, which is a lot of this seems to hinge on when the exam, the kind of coincidence of just when the exam's scheduled. Like, if it exists at that moment, right, that it would seem to satisfy the first element. If it doesn't exist, it's okay, you're out of luck. I'm struggling to understand why. Like how this before after plays out with the first element, the additional disability.
Let's add another 10 minutes, please.
Your Honors, the I'm struggling a little bit now. If the exam took place during the time when the wound was in existence, I would agree that there was an additional disability.
But how can that be? I understand it's a difficult question, but your answer just conceded the element. There would be an additional disability. You said if it happened to have observed the wound while it was existing. Now, for instance, I think it's completely plausible to read the evidence and say, listen, there's no wound now. Whatever wound may have existed in the past obviously was not a big deal. And the fact that it doesn't exist now is probative to maybe what it may have looked like when it did exist. Like, that to me is absolutely reasonable. But to say that there's no additional disability because I can't right now see it, that speaks more to when the actual exam was scheduled and took place. Second, as a legal matter, I just don't see this before-after that we propose as being something that we iterate in future cases because it just seems to be kind of, random as to whether someone would satisfy the first element. And so I understand it's a difficult question, but it's because I think the framework that you proposed is I think it just might not fit the actual law. So I understand it's a big question, and now it's more of a comment than a question, but like, if you can speak to this, why should we invest all of our sort of, why should we focus so exclusively on this first element? And you're asking us to do like a really restrictive version of this first element that will have big effects on future cases, as opposed to just, listen, go to the third element. There's lots of things we can look at. They're all relevant to whether they can establish this. And then we can just let the facts speak for themselves. That's a much easier sell, from my opinion, as of your position. But if you want me to go to the more like conceptually difficult, please explain why we should do that.
Your Honor, my first response to that would be that what this court has laid out in previous decisions, that an 1151 claim, if you don't have an additional disability, it's fatal to the claim. So I'm only arguing to continue the law as it currently stands, and that the board applied, and it was reasonable in applying it. If you think that the additional disability should be done away with and just focus on proximate cause, then I guess that would require a change in the law, in the application of how we handle 1151 claims. But I believe overarching all of this is with the congressional intent is to compensate veterans for medical malpractice. That's what the 1151 intent is. And in that context, the three elements make sense, and that they have to be met one after the other before the veteran can proceed. We have to draw the line. We would like to compensate everybody for everything, but there has to be a framework in which we all operate, and we do that. That would be my answer to you, Your Honor.
Thanks.
I just wanted to add, I think we've addressed the discrepancy between the measurements, one being the scar and one being the wound. I wonder if you have anything more to add on this requirement per the regulation to actually compare the wound before the procedure and after. So your argument would be that before the procedure there was no wound, and so whatever the snapshot in time was afterwards that measured, and let's say for the sake of discussion, that's the 2 centimeters, that was the after and eventually the healing of the wound entirely. Is that your argument?
My response to that would be, if we assume for a second that he did not have his gallbladder removed and he had no scar in that area, it was just uncompromised skin on his stomach, and he went in to have this procedure and had a scar afterwards, then I think it would be a different discussion that the scar could possibly be a additional disability, depending on what that scar looks like and what is... Yes, that would be fact-dependent on then those circumstances. These cases are very fact-dependent, I would submit. But that's not, I argue, what we have here.
But just to frame it for purposes of defining the additional disability that the veteran has claimed here, it would be the post-RFA procedure wound for whatever period of time could be established that the wound existed before completely healing, correct?
Yes, Your Honor, that is correct. There was temporarily a wound, yes.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Kupke. If you want to wrap up for a sentence or two, and then we'll move to rebuttal.
Thank you, Chief Judge. I have nothing else to add. I respectfully request that the court affirm the board decision finding no additional disability and no entitlement to 1151 compensation. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Kupke. And Mr. Kinman, you may move ahead with your rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. This case is really about the first element, the additional disability. And we already have a regulation that fits. The regulation, you look at the before and the after picture. Before this radio frequency ablation, the veteran had a scar, and a scar that was painful. After the procedure was performed, he had an open wound and a MRSA infection. And then later on down the line, perhaps a bigger scar that's formed. I don't think the record's clear one way or the other on that. But the picture of the before and the after with the MRSA infection and a wound is an additional disability. And this element shouldn't be so difficult for the veterans to overcome. I think what's happening here is the secretary is confluding the first element with the remaining elements, whether or not this was a proximate cause of the disability, whether or not it was reasonably foreseeable. That's not relevant as to whether or not there's an additional disability. If the secretary's position was to be adopted, let's look at a different fact scenario. Let's look if A veteran has a knee injury and he goes in and they operate on the wrong leg. And then at that operation, you know, he gets an infection in that knee, that the wrong one that they operated on. The secretary's argument would be that's irrelevant because he didn't have an additional disability because the knee eventually healed. Our argument is when there's an infection and an open wound, that is an additional disability. And then the case should proceed to the further elements. Was it reasonably foreseeable? Was there proximate cause? I think it's also telling that the secretary stated if the exam had taken place in a timely manner, that then there would be an additional disability. You know, the veteran in this case filed his claim under 1151 during the time he had an open wound on his leg. And it's not his fault that there was not a CMP exam for 5 years later. To say that if the CMP examiner would have seen him at the time the wound was there, then the VA would concede that he has an additional disability is not fair to the veteran, is not fair to Mr. Stevenson, given that he was timely with his filing. I would concede, certainly, if he had filed his claim in 2019 and at that time he didn't have the open wound and the scar was the exact same and there was no pain, he wouldn't have a claim. But he filed this 1151 claim at the time that he had the open wound. And because of that, that is an additional disability. I think the board decision, the CMP examiner, they're clear in their decisions that they're basing their opinions on that there's no additional disability. The board is clear that that's why they denied it. The medical opinion from 2019, most of the questions are answered with the first line, there is no additional disability. And our request is that this matter be determined that there is an additional disability. I think we can use the existing framework and say that if there's an after picture that is different than the before picture, which in this case there is. There's an open wound on a leg with a MRSA infection, but that is enough for an additional disability. And then let's argue the third and the second elements and argue if it was reasonably foreseeable or if there was malpractice. So overall, Your Honors, that is what the appellant is requesting. Have this matter be remanded. Have a determination be made that there was an additional disability, that should not be a difficult process, that it should be clear when there's something else that is different on the body from when the procedure started. Have that be the additional disability element, and then let's proceed to the additional factors.
Now, Mr. Pinion, in your brief, I believe that you requested remand so that the board could provide reasons or bases as to why there was no additional disability. Are you now asking us to find that indeed there is an additional disability?
Excuse me. I think that would speed the process up. The problem is the board didn't explain fairly to the veteran why there was not an additional disability. The board didn't go into an explanation as to why MRSA, an open wound, potentially a bigger scar, would not qualify as an additional disability. I think it's clear during those months he had an additional disability. And so that is a finding where the board is asserting that there's no additional disability because of other factors that are irrelevant. I'd ask this court to craft an order focusing the board on whether or not the before and the after picture looks differently, whether that's a order to the board to explain more reasons or bases, or whether it's just an order saying the facts are clear in this matter, the board improperly looked at other factors such as the proximate cause and whether or not it was reasonably foreseeable, but based on the disability picture here, there was an additional disability.
Counsel, There would be limits, though, to what's an additional disability. I mean, it's limits beyond just sort of comparing before and after. For instance, like the natural progression of a condition may look different after than before, right? But that can't fit within the definition. So the regulation doesn't define the term additional disability. It just sort of gives a methodology that we can you know, come up with it. What would you, I mean, what would you exclude from that definition? What would not be included in your definition?
Sure.
So, go ahead.
I think you'd have to, again, just look at the before and afters. I don't think this should be a step that is overtly difficult for the veterans. If there's a surgery and everything goes well, I don't foresee the VA is going to have, you know, claimants claiming 1151 because they were drowned after the surgery.
So what about pain? I mean, let's ask you, like, you know, you have a surgery. It's absolutely natural that it's painful. Should we consider pain as an additional disability, or is that just part of the surgery?
I think that pain could be an additional disability, because if the pain was not there beforehand and it's there afterwards, that's an additional disability. Now, certainly that claim is not going to survive the second and third steps, because, you know, unless the VA did not have a consent form signed.
What about the wound? Say the wound from the surgery.
Again,
you didn't have it before.
Again, I do believe that would be an additional disability, even if the wound is a normal operative procedure. Again, you'd go to the second and third steps, and that claim would be denied quickly by saying that this is a normal progress or progression. You know, you had to have a knee surgery. We had to cut you open. I don't foresee that being a problem of, you know, veterans rushing to file 1151 claim because of normal surgery actions.
The only limit that you'd maybe recognize would be the natural progression of the condition itself. That would be really the only thing that you'd rule out. So is that fair to say?
Or non-changeable medical procedure. For example, you go in for a CT scan or an MRI, and you come out of the MRI machine with no additional problems, you can't claim that as an 1151 claim. There has to be some difference, something that has happened, some change that has occurred, whether that's an infection, a wound, something that has changed, or pain. But simply just going in for a procedure, maybe the MRI is done wrong, that's not the purpose of an 1151 statute.
Okay, thank you.
If this court would have no further questions.
No further questions, Mr. Kinman.
I do thank you for the time this afternoon. On behalf of myself and Mr. Stevenson, it is much appreciated. Thank you, Your Honors, and have a great rest of the day.
The court wants to thank both counsel for your arguments, and the case is submitted for consideration.
All rise. The court is in recess.